The peaceful transfer of power has begun as President Joe Biden welcomes President-elect Donald Trump to the Oval Office to discuss the transition between their administrations.
Many Catholics held their nose to vote for Donald Trump on the policy issue, even though they're very dissatisfied with him on the personal issue.
How did the Catholic vote influence this election? Expert analysis of the numbers, as we recognize those who identify as Catholic do not represent a monolithic voting bloc. At their annual fall meeting, America's Catholic bishops react to the presidential election and the way forward with a new administration.
A lot of people are still without power. A lot of people are still without water. They just need a lot of help from the community.
And we are in Western North Carolina, as some residents there continue to struggle in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. The Diocese of Charlotte steps up, and Catholic volunteers help to bring back stability to those in need. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
There's a lot of Catholic voters in America. Let's just be clear about that. They're one of the largest voting blocks. And if a politician managed to win even 5% more or 10% more than the prior race, that could be more than enough to swing an election.
Catholic-identifying voters, a key constituency in the decision to return the 45th president, Donald Trump, to the Oval Office as our nation's 47th president. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadrow. The transition to a new administration is proceeding quickly. President Joe Biden welcomed President-elect Donald Trump to the White House on Wednesday. It is a traditional part of the peaceful handoff of power between U.S. presidents, a longtime ritual not extended to Biden 4 years ago.
Well, Mr. President-elect and former president and Donald, congratulations. And looking forward to having a, like we said, smooth transition. Do everything we can to make sure you're accommodated, what you need. And we're going to get a chance to talk about some of that today.
So good.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much. And politics is tough. And it's, in many cases, not a very nice world. But it is a nice world today. And I appreciate it very much. And a transition that's so smooth, it'll be as smooth as it can get. And I very much appreciate that, Jim.
You're welcome.
The Biden-Trump conversation extended another 2 hours behind closed doors. Trump told the New York Post it was a gracious meeting in which he solicited Biden's opinion about the war in Ukraine and the conflict between Israel and Hamas. It's been a little over 1 week since the election in which Trump bested Vice President Kamala Harris. And as the nation's capital prepares for the transition in both the White House and in Congress, analysts are picking apart last week's results. One key demographic that sticks out, voters who identify as Catholic, who make up roughly one-fifth of the electorate. What many consider the block of, quote, Catholic voters is actually quite a diverse group, comprised of those both practicing and non-practicing. Pew Research found only 28% of U.S. Catholics attend weekly Mass. 68% say they attend a few times a year or less. Only 20% of those who identify as Catholics attend Mass weekly, pray daily, and consider religion very important in their life. A majority of Catholics in the U.S. are white, but one-third are Hispanic, a percentage that continues to grow. This expansive group of voters can be hard to define or generalize, and it can be challenging to pinpoint nuances and break down exactly how each Catholic voted. But overall, exit polls show a majority of those Catholic-identifying voters backed Donald Trump.
And as the Catholic vote goes, so does the country.
One of the biggest religious blocs in the country, voters who identify as Catholic, make up around 22% of the entire electorate. And this time around, a majority of them backed former President Donald Trump. According to VoteCast, a survey of more than 120,000 voters by the Associated Press, 54% of Catholic-identifying voters cast a ballot for Trump. 45% voted for Vice President Kamala Harris. That's an increase from what the same poll found 4 years ago, when 50% backed Trump in 2020 and 49% backed President Joe Biden. Analyzing the broad population of Catholics, practicing and non-practicing alike, who turned out for candidates. Statistician Ryan Burge discussed the trends.
It's amazing how well Trump did with basically everyone. He won with older Catholics, with younger Catholics, with female Catholics, with male Catholics, with white Catholics. And he also, you know, made it a much closer race with Hispanic Catholics as well. It was really an across the board win for Donald Trump.
Trump also made gains with Hispanic voters who identify as Catholic.
I think the Hispanic Catholic vote has definitely gone from being a 2-to-1 Democrat to Republican vote to a much closer to 50-50, which creates real problems for the Democrats in a lot of those swing states that tend to have a lot of Hispanic Catholics.
When speaking to students on the Catholic University of America campus, they're not surprised at voters who identified as Catholic backing Trump.
Appointing 3 pro-life justices to the Supreme Court, which led to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, I think that was another major thing.
I think that a lot of his policies and that kind of what he stands for kind of aligns with, like, the Catholic or, like, Christian, like, what word am I looking for? Like, their, like, traditions or, like, their morals. So I feel like that kind of is expected.
They really care about religious freedom and you know, and a good economy and that sort of thing, and having good family values, and I think that's why the majority voted for Trump.
Burge says the plurality of Catholic-identifying voters' priorities mirrored the rest of America.
Catholic voters seem like they were concerned with the economy most, which is what most voters were concerned with. And immigration comes in a close second. I think that's one of the reasons we saw such a wide swath of voters move towards the Republican side this time.
On some moral issues, Trump put his campaign at odds with church teaching. He voiced his support for in vitro fertilization, a fertility procedure that the Catholic Church teaches is morally impermissible, to which then-candidate Donald Trump had not considered religious exemptions. And to the dismay of many pro-life advocates, he softened his stance on abortion, arguing it was now up to the states. Dr. Kenneth Craycraft, practicing attorney and moral theology professor, thinks that middle approach earned Trump some votes, even among those who support legal abortion.
I also think that what we saw in the election is that a majority of the voting public do not want the extreme abortion agenda that Kamala Harris was advocating for and campaigning on in this campaign.
He points to one moment just weeks before the election when Harris spoke about religious exemptions for abortion in an interview with NBC News.
What concessions would be on the table? Religious exemptions, for example, is that something that you would consider?
I don't think we should be making concessions when we're talking about a fundamental freedom to make decisions about your own body.
I think that lost a lot of people. If she had answered that question differently, I think it would have changed things.
Craycraft says Trump's focus on transgender ideology, especially toward the end of the election cycle, with a targeted ad campaign, set him apart from the Democratic ticket.
I really don't think that many Catholic voters realized just how radical the transgender ideology is and how much damage it has been doing to young people, especially in the U.S. And I really think that that resonated with Catholic voters in such a way that it motivated Catholic voters to vote for Donald Trump instead of Kamala Harris.
So the question remains, what part did this voting bloc play in Trump's electoral sweep? With much more post-election analysis to be done, the answer remains to be seen.
But I do think that the Catholic vote was more instrumental in this election than perhaps even I thought it would be. I think that though the issues of abortion, the issue and transgender ideology and similar issues motivated the Catholic vote in a way that perhaps I was even surprised by. So I think Catholics had a strong role in the outcome of this election.
As the election voting statistics come into greater focus and the presidential peaceful transfer of power is underway, Congress itself took steps to solidify its own leadership. On Wednesday, Senate Republicans voted by secret ballot to elevate South Dakota Senator John Thune to become majority leader now that the GOP has captured the most seats in the upper chamber. Thune was a top deputy to former Republican leader Mitch McConnell and replaces him in the position. Thune is in his fourth Senate term and has promised to work closely closely with President-elect Trump to push through his policy agenda, despite some differences they've had over the years. Also on Wednesday, by a voice vote, House Speaker Mike Johnson won the nomination for a full two-year term in the top job after running unopposed. He will now face an official vote of the full House in January. Johnson was once viewed as an interim speaker after he replaced Kevin McCarthy, who was removed through a motion to vacate in 2023. President-elect Trump has fully endorsed Johnson, saying he's with him all the way. And personnel announcements from the president-elect regarding his administration came fast and furious this week as he nominated numerous cabinet members and other top officials. As these nominees work their way through the confirmation process and are quickly developing, we are not presenting a full list right now, but do want to mention one of particular interest to our audience, Catholic Florida Senator Marco Rubio, as Trump's pick for Secretary of State. Rubio appeared on the world over with Raymond Arroyo last week, just 2 days after the election, but before his cabinet nomination. Rubio has long said his Catholic faith informs his positions on public policy. A leading member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Rubio shared his philosophy with EWTN on what he feels should be the next direction of America's foreign policy.
I came to the Senate in 2010. The world we have today looks nothing like the world did in 2010. In 2010, we were in the last years of this unipolar world, right, where the United States basically was the sole superpower. Today, we're not in that world. Today, we are now in a world where China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran are increasingly cooperating with one another to undermine our interests in the world. We have now entered an era that has similarities to the Cold War in that it requires us to be pragmatic, and it requires us, you know, we are the greatest country in the world. We're the richest. We're the most powerful. But we, too, have limited resources. Every country does. And so we have to invest both our time and our money on things that serve our core national interest. We have to. And so there are a lot of great causes in the world, but we can't be involved in all of them. We just can't. We can't afford it. And no country can. You spread yourself too thin. We have to define what are our core national interests as a nation. And we have to really prioritize those.
There is no word when cabinet confirmation hearings might begin, but as a longtime member of the Senate, it appears Rubio will have the support of his Senate colleagues for confirmation to become Secretary of State. Getting back to the election itself, in an article published this week, The New Yorker portrays part of Trump's strategy to win the 2024 election was to sideline the established pro-life movement in order to build a new vision of conservative family policy. In the article, The New Pro-Life Playbook, reporter Emma Green writes, "For two generations, members of the pro-life movement were oriented around the political and legal goal of overturning Roe. Along the way, they lost the culture. The next Trump administration will be staffed with people who wish to change that." To discuss this topic and what the shifting GOP strategy on abortion reveals about our current political climate, we're joined now by Emma Green. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, was previously a staff writer for The Atlantic, and joins us now from New York City. Emma, thank you so much for joining us. Really fascinating reporting. And I want to go ahead and highlight one of the other major points that you made. You write, quote, "Social conservatives within Trump's coalition have been workshopping a new playbook. They have a much broader social policy agenda in mind for his next term, overhauling the way Republicans think and talk about family." Emma, can you go ahead and expand on that? How are Republicans shifting how they talk about the family and why?
You know, as I started reporting this story, I was interested in this question of where the pro-life movement is in this moment post-Dobbs and heading into the presidential election, now a new presidential administration. And the thing I kept hearing over and over from people who are part of traditional pro-life groups, but also part of this broader pro-family scene, is a desire to focus on this question of family in all aspects of federal policymaking. So to have it, as the head of the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, told me, be the North Star for how they think about policy. And this is taking family policy beyond the areas that we normally think of, such as the child tax credit or tax credits for child and dependent care, going to issues like housing and thinking about housing regulation and availability as a family issue, thinking about trade and tariffs as a family issue. Can men get jobs that will allow them to support a family and be a single breadwinner so that potentially a mom who wanted to could stay home with her children? It's this expansive vision that that frames family policy as the center of everything that the Republicans can do, that to me is the real shift here. Mm-hmm. And I'll be interested to see how much momentum that gets as President Trump takes office mm-hmm. and the new in session. Mm.
As one of your interviewees phrased it, pro-life is out, pro-family is in. And with this shift away from a focus on abortion, how have pro-life leaders been reacting to this new tactic?
I think there's a lot of frustration. You know, not everyone is willing to talk ahead of an election season and be open and honest and vulnerable about their sense of political weakness. But my perception from the people who were willing to talk to me is that that is what people are feeling, a sense of marginalization within the GOP coalition, a sense of political vulnerability and weakness around very specific pro-life goals, meaning abortion restrictions. And, you know, it was pretty clear for everybody to see that President Trump, during his campaign, tried to put distance between himself and the pro-life movement, very different from how he campaigned for his first win in 2016. So obviously, across the pro-life movement, which is very large, very diverse, and very grassroots, there are lots of different perceptions about what the right path forward is and what the politics are going to look like. Mm-hmm. But from my interviews, the strong sense that I got was a sense that people are frustrated. They wish that there was more attention being paid to these issues within the GOP coalition. And there's a sense of uncertainty about what the pro-life movement will look like moving forward.
Emma, you know, historically, conservatives have fought against expanded government spending. But is that no longer the case, especially with, as you mentioned, this push for child tax credits and so forth?
Within a segment of the conservative coalition, what I called in my article, the realignment conservatives, mm-hmm. but they've also been called national conservatives, the new right, there is a growing sense that there's been too much reticence on the right to do things that are good, to do things that help people in the way that conservatives wish people to be helped. So they're very much in favor of expanded government spending if it's going to help people to have kids and to have families, to get rid of some of those old hangups within the GOP coalition around small government. And I saw this both at the federal level, hearing people who are around, for example, Vice President-elect J.D. Vance and how they think about this potentially from the federal level, but also at the state level. And we saw this especially in the wake of Dobbs, that many of the states, all of the states that have restrictions in place after Dobbs on abortion have also passed expansions to the social safety net. And this state that I spotlight in my reporting was Mississippi, where it all started with the Dobbs decision. And it was clear that in Mississippi, there are people, especially Attorney General Lynn Fitch, who led the Dobbs case, who are pressing the Republican legislature to be more willing to step out and help people to expand the social safety net in ways that potentially they haven't been willing to in the past.
How much of this new vision that we're talking about is being shaped specifically by Catholics and Catholic thought? You mentioned Vice Presidential nominee J.D. Vance. He's one of the biggest proponents of it, and he's notably a convert to Catholicism.
I think J.D. Vance is a prime example of someone who's clearly been shaped by his conversion to Catholicism and the way that he thinks and articulates his vision of the good. Notably, his shift to Catholicism also followed a political shift. He was more libertarian in past iterations of his political life, now is much more open to this idea that the government is going to have to spend money. And indeed, he said that on the campaign trail. But there are many other prominent Catholics who are also involved with this new pro-family vision. Kevin Roberts, who is the head of the Heritage Foundation, someone that I interviewed for this piece, is a great example of someone who really believes in the pro-family vision. It was a big topic in his book. And he himself is both Catholic and has been a leader of a Catholic institution, Wyoming Catholic College. So I think that influence theologically, religiously, the sensibility around helping people, reaching out to the margins, the vulnerable, seeing the way that government policy and politics might be able to work in that direction, it's a huge influence in this movement.
Emma, as we're continuing to sift through the election results, I mean, there were states where both Trump won and the abortion ballot initiative succeeded. So you had voters who were voting both for Trump and for abortion. In your opinion, does this reveal that Trump's abortion strategy ultimately paid off this election?
I think there will be many autopsies done on this election, but I think it is very clear at this moment that President Trump made a calculation that putting distance between himself and the pro-life movement in the most traditional sense, meaning anti-abortion in all of its forms, that it was a calculation that he made and potentially that it paid off. And we are already hearing from voters who describe themselves as being both pro-choice and pro-Trump, who didn't see a vote for President Trump as necessarily a vote for the pro-life movement or a vote against abortion. And so I do think that that's the strategy that the Trump administration and the Trump campaign have taken. Whether or not that continues, I think, is a question. And certainly going into the new administration, I would guess there will be a lot of action at the administrative level to try to shore up some of those restrictions on abortion at the federal level and to reverse some of the Biden administration's policies. But whether or not the pro-life movement has influence with the new Trump administration, I think, is an open question.
Absolutely. Something that we're all very intrigued to see how that plays out. Emma Green, thank you so much for your reporting and for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come on EWTN News in Depth, this election and its impact are being closely monitored elsewhere, including inside the Catholic Church. Comments and thoughts from our U.S. Catholic bishops during their annual fall meeting.
This is a time for us to reassert our particular role in the midst of a world that we believe desperately needs God.
Observations from some prominent church leaders this week as they contemplate the next 4 years with a new president in the Oval Office. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has two major meetings a year. The fall meeting happened this past week in Baltimore. Reporter Mark Irons was there and says much of the conversation centered around how the change in leadership at the White House will impact Catholic priorities.
We are not politicians. We're pastors. Our lens is the gospel. Our lens is the teaching of our church.
Hundreds of Catholic bishops gathered for their annual fall meeting in Baltimore, 1 week after the U.S. presidential election.
Congratulations.
As the country prepares for a transition of political power from the Biden to Trump administration, Archbishop Timothy Broglio, the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, reaffirmed the bishops' commitment to unchanging gospel truth.
We proclaim it in and out of season. We must insist on the dignity of the human person from womb to tomb, to see Christ in those who are most in need, to defend and lift up the poor.
Two areas of concern were addressed by bishops this week: immigration and abortion. On Election Day, voters in Nebraska, Florida, and South Dakota rejected pro-abortion ballot measures. Bishop Michael Burbidge, the outgoing chairman of the USCCB Committee on Pro-Life Activities, acknowledged those victories, but recognized that in seven other states, voters decided to expand abortion access, and the effort to defend vulnerable life must continue.
Making clear the extreme positions of those who are working to legalize abortion in their states.
Along with preborn children, the bishops are defending the rights of vulnerable immigrants. In a statement this week, they called for a secure border, enforcement policies to stop gang activity, the flow of drugs, and human trafficking. And they also said, recognizing the inherent dignity of each person as a child of God, we stand in firm solidarity with our immigrant brothers and sisters who live and labor in these United States. The statement did not explicitly mention President-elect Donald Trump or his proposed immigration policies, but when asked about the incoming administration, Bishop Mark Seitz, chairman of the USCCB Committee on Migration, said this.
When it comes to the area of immigration, we are concerned based on the rhetoric before the election.
Bishop Seitz says it remains to be seen if reality will match the rhetoric. During the campaign, Trump said he would carry out the largest deportation of undocumented immigrants in American history. The president of the Bishops' Conference has encouraged immigration reform while recalling a gospel mandate.
We certainly do not encourage illegal immigration, but we will all have to stand before the throne of grace and hear the Lord ask us if we saw him in the hungry, thirsty, naked, homeless, stranger, or sick, and responded to his needs.
And Bishop Seitz said the church shouldn't be restricted by state authorities from giving material assistance to migrants in need, regardless of their immigration status.
We need to be allowed to care for them without saying, first of all, show me your papers.
It is a deeply personal issue because my brothers were immigrants, my parents were immigrants.
Bishop Earl Fernandez mentioned the growing number of Hispanic and African immigrants who are bringing spiritual vitality to his diocese in Columbus, Ohio, and helping the local economy. And he reflects on the role of faith in his upbringing as the son of Indian immigrants.
My mother, I distinctly remember her saying, "We don't have anyone in this country except each other in the church, so you boys are going to have to work hard and pray hard and study hard," and made all the difference in the world for us.
This is an emotional issue for you.
It is. I mean, for me, the faith is everything, and to be able to offer faith to people who are in hopeless situations.
According to one Pew Research study, 63% of Trump supporters say there should be a national effort to deport undocumented immigrants currently living in the U.S.
What do you say to those people specifically who you know, really think that this makes sense, and why shouldn't we do this?
Well, I would say it's much more complicated than that. Okay, they should be deported, but what if their children are American citizens? What if it means breaking up a family? What if it means, okay, you deport them, but that you don't have enough workers in your community?
President Joe Biden, the nation's second Catholic president, will leave office as J.D. Vance becomes the nation's second Catholic vice president. Following the lead of Trump, Vance has voiced support for the availability of the abortion pill and a possible IVF government mandate. Both of those positions would conflict with Catholic teaching. We asked Bishop Burbidge to respond to what Vance has said.
First of all, I don't think it's appropriate right now to react to what we've heard on a campaign trail.
But he said the bishops will respond to policies and advocate that they respect life.
We'll continue to watch and listen and then respond appropriately as pastors and teachers of the truth.
And looking ahead to future political elections, we asked Bishop Daniel Flores of the Diocese of Brownsville, Texas, if the Bishop's Conference will update Forming Consciences for Faithful Citizenship. It's a document focused on Catholic social teaching, which serves as a guide to voters.
What is the future of that document? Have there been discussions here? Do you foresee any changes, any updates? What is it look like going forward?
Whatever we would do wouldn't change the substance of the teaching of the, because the church's teaching on conscience is like pretty settled. The message is pretty basic, but how it's communicated is something that at some point we're going to have to look at.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
While the American election was part of the conversation at the bishop's fall meeting, talk of the recent synod on synodality at the Vatican was also heavily discussed. Bishop Daniel Flores of Brownsville, Texas, whom you just saw, is the doctrinal head of the USCCB and attended the synod as a bishop delegate. He gave a comprehensive report this week to his American brother bishops about what happened in Rome. Mark Irons continued his conversation with him in Baltimore about just that and more. Here's Bishop Daniel Flores on the record.
Bishop Daniel Flores, thank you so much for taking the time.
Good to be here. Thank you.
You were a delegate at the now concluded Synod on Synodality in Rome. What was your message to your brother U.S. bishops here? What was the main takeaway for you that you wanted to share?
My main focus was helping them to understand kind of where we are right now in terms of what this the general session as it concluded, kind of where what the Holy Father's message was to us. It's a conference, but to the whole world in terms of the next steps. And so I tried to kind of outline some of that, some of the work we can continue to do in our dioceses, but then mostly to kind of look at the document that the Holy Father received and now sent out to the world and see and just study it, pray it with our communities, consultatively with just our own people in our own dioceses. That's the first thing, is we really have to kind of take it to heart.
What does synodality look like playing out practically at the local level? What should Catholics in the pews across the U.S. expect?
Well, with time, because it is kind of a patient sort of unfolding of a kind of a shift in the way we sort of make decisions, and maybe one element of it that would be more collaborative, more participative, to kind of, you know, at the local level, just to kind of like in our parish councils, hearing from as many people as we can to help sort of the decision-making process for the sake of the mission. Because I think what really was very strong from the Holy Father's message to us is that the work of our communion, which is our how we work together, collaborate, how we share responsibility for the mission of the church really has to be for the sake of the mission. That is, the credibility of our announcing of the gospel, the charitable work that we do, the justice work that we do, the work with our young people, all has to aim towards announcing Christ and the evangelization. But we have to improve the way we sort of work with each other. It's not just these people do that, these people do that, they never talk to each other. It's a communion. That's what we are. We could say metaphysically, because that's what baptism does to us. It makes us a people. But we have to live that way more practically on the local level. So I would look for ways. I mean, expect that in time, parishes, as they kind of think of it, will look for ways to kind of invite people to be more expressive as to kind of how they would like to participate in the mission. But it's a local thing in a lot of cases.
Following the conclusion of the Synod and the Pope's approval of the final document, do you foresee any future changes when it comes to church canon law, in particular when it comes to either, say, the structure or authority of episcopal conferences such as the USCCB?
That's a good question. I think that question will be looked at. If it is, it will be. I suspect it'll be just slight shifts, because one of the things that the synodal consultation sort of brought to light is that Episcopal conferences in the history of the world are a fairly recent thing. That is, since the Second Vatican Council, the ancient and still active sort of structure of the church is the diocese in a metropolitan, and then you have a region, then you have a country. But the metropolitan province sort of thing is sort of the basic structure of the communion. So what needs to be thought about is how does the Episcopal conference, which is sort of as a national entity, which is sort of developed after the Second Vatican, how does that fit as an expression of communion? Because the communion of the local churches, dioceses, provinces, and conferences is the communion which is guaranteed by this successor, Peter. And so it's how does that work? I think there may be some shifts but I would not look for a huge, oh my goodness, today they've done this and now it's all different. No, it's sort of, part of it will be recognition, part of it will be, but it's not the same, and so there are limits. We'll have to see, because that's going to have to be a worldwide consultation, because it's not just what the U.S. thinks. You know, that's one of the things about synodality while I was there, is you heard from bishops and lay people all over the world, and not everything is the same as it is here, which is everybody thinks.
The bishops are meeting 1 week after the election of President Donald Trump. He has said he will deport millions of undocumented immigrants. As the bishop of a diocese on the border in the Diocese of Brownsville, Texas, what is your reaction to that? What is your response?
The first thing is, I pray for the current president, and I pray for the president-elect. I think we have to pray for our elected leaders, and not just presidents, but Congress. I know that the president-elect said those sorts of things. I think what we have to do in my diocese is just to kind of pay attention to kind of, once the administration begins, what form would it take to kind of move in that direction and be prepared? One would rightly assume that whatever decisions are made, they would be according to the dictates of law that is in effect until the laws are changed. And so that would be something that we would look at. In what manner would this be done? What's the way it would be done? And also, as a church, and certainly in my diocese, but I think the bishops of the United States would, you know, we always look to defend the reality of the human beings that are affected, and to defend the dignity of the human person and human families. And that's just a reality that the church has to speak about, and will certainly do, but it's too early to tell what it would look like. But, you know, if the other party had won, we would be having this conversation, but about different issues. But that's because the Catholic social teaching, that is about public order, it doesn't have a perfect fit in either of the larger political parties in this country. So we have to be prepared for whichever one, and we'll have to deal with that. But always in response to kind of what's actually happening, and not what people predict, this is the way it's going to happen. I think we have to hope that the people who continue to govern us will share a basic understanding the church has about the dignity of the human person, and then move from there.
Catholic voters overall broke for Trump. Actually, 54% supported him this election. He also made significant gains with Hispanic voters. Did any of this surprise you?
No, it didn't particularly surprise me.
No.
And I mean, and I'm not one to judge how people make their decisions. I mean, I'm a bishop. I teach what the church teaches from the pulpit and elsewhere. But I really do trust that people struggle hard to make decisions to vote. And I'm not going to judge one way or the other why people make the decisions. But because that's part of the electoral process, but it's also part of the mission of the church is to form the conscience, as the Pope says, and not replace it. So, was I surprised? No, but then not surprised because we're living at a time when not a lot surprises me in terms of, like, the way we pivot on different things. I would just urge both parties to listen more to the people heart to heart, and which I think is something that the church is encouraging all around. You know, and I'm talking about local level politics. You really have to know the community, and that's something that, and if you do, and there's a human face to it, then the governing decisions are more humane in whichever way you're.
Bishop Flores, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. God bless you.
We turn next to Catholic Service, how the church community is stepping up to help folks in North Carolina after the devastation of Hurricane Helene.
I'm Rosal Regis, and I'm in Asheville, North Carolina, where relief and recovery efforts are still ongoing, 1 month after Hurricane Helene. We'll have more for you coming up next.
When we return, we check back in on the weather wounds that still need healing in western North Carolina following the devastation caused by Hurricane Helene. We tell you about the special help coming from Catholic volunteers looking after their neighbors. Often in our fast-paced news world, our immediate attention jumps from one crisis to the next, with little time or desire to revisit the original event. This week, EWTN News In Depth is looking back nearly 2 months now to check up on those hard-hit areas in western North Carolina so devastated by Hurricane Helene. Reporter Roselle Regis says as communities struggle to recover, the Catholic Church in the Diocese of Charlotte is instrumental in helping the region regain some normalcy.
Part of our brain is shut down, I think, because we don't want to or are not able to face that devastation.
Downed trees, silt and mud on the roads, vehicle turned over, and debris on the side of the road.
Where did everything go? It's gone. It's really hard to comprehend the destruction.
These are the remnants of Hurricane Helene, the deadliest and most damaging storm to ever hit North Carolina.
We had a car and our clothes, and that was literally all we had.
It has been more than a month since the storm, and while some areas of Asheville are slowly recovering and getting back to some normalcy, many homes are still uninhabitable without working plumbing and drinking water. The hardest hit, Buncombe County, which includes the cities of Asheville, Black Mountain, and Swannanoa, have reported 43 deaths and more than 1,000 homes damaged or destroyed, affecting 200,000 people.
I'm in the middle of what used to be a beautiful neighborhood in East Asheville. What you see around me is what floodwaters left behind. It destroyed everything in its path, including houses, trees, and roads.
Brandon Schneeberger and his wife lived in one of these houses.
We heard a hurricane was coming, and it was sort of like the boy who cries wolf. We thought, this is maybe it's going to be a little bit bad, but it surely our house won't be flooded.
As Hurricane Helene made landfall, and as the water in the nearby river continued to rise, Brandon knew it was time to leave. He and his wife hopped in their car and left for higher ground.
We were up there for about 3 days. Stranded because when the river receded, there was mud was all over the road and there were trees down and stuff, that sort of thing, so we couldn't leave. We finally got back down to the house on Friday, and there was nothing that we could really salvage at the time.
Brandon and his wife lost their home and everything in it.
It's completely destroyed, yeah. The river came about 2 feet over the roof line and took everything, or destroyed everything.
Michael Warnock shared a similar story.
I have a business in the River Arts District, and that business had flooded away on Friday morning. And our personal residence is in Montreat, North Carolina, and it was hit by a landslide and fallen trees.
Michael hopes to get his house back in living condition soon. But his business, on the other hand, was obliterated. Michael is a craftsman and had a custom furniture shop in Asheville.
So 3 days after the flood, our landlords told us, hey, everything is gone, but there's a random workbench downriver on a pile of rubble, and it says, my friend St. Joseph, pray for me. And I thought, wow, that's my bench. And he said, it's almost unscathed.
He also found his crucifix greeting him at the entrance.
Another thing that was really interesting is my blessed crucifix just managed to stay on that wall. I have no idea how it did. It was just a little nail, but it stayed there.
Both Brandon and Michael are parishioners of St. Margaret Mary Church in Swannanoa. As both men grieve their losses, they turn to the faith for guidance and strength.
I keep asking God, why did this happen? Why did this happen? But when I look at the crucifix, when I look at Christ on the cross, it's very comforting because this is what Christianity is. It's going through, it's sharing in the sufferings of Christ. And he went through much more than we ever will have to.
We have hope. And what's been very encouraging is just the generosity of others. So many family and friends have been overwhelmingly generous to you know, help us and give us hope to rebuild.
Dwayne and Janelle Hensley, who lost their home as well, continue to turn to prayer. They came back to find everything inside their house a total loss. Samaritan's Purse, a Christian humanitarian aid organization based in North Carolina, stepped in to help.
Well, the first day it was overwhelming. It was, and they were picking up our stuff and throwing it in the yard. They were very kind about it, and they would ask, do you want to save this? And they were really, really sweet about it. But it was hard. It was really hard to watch.
Stacks of debris, furniture, toys, pictures from scrapbooks and photo albums scattered can be seen in front of their yard. Work is being done to try to salvage their home. But despite the loss, the Hensleys have hope.
I can tell you that my experience, and I've got a little bit behind me now, God has never taken anything away from me that he didn't replace it with something better.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So my hope is in the Lord and what his plan is.
About 15 minutes away from downtown Asheville, St. Andrew the Apostle Catholic Church turned into a relief center, distributing emergency supplies just days after the hurricane.
We want to help. We want to do what we can. And we asked Father, and he said, as long as you have volunteers to work it, you can do what you need, what you feel like called to do. So this is what we're doing. We have the entire church, everything except Father's office is used to store something or another.
Parish Secretary Kelly Hansen and other parishioners volunteered to collect, organize, and distribute donations to anyone in need. There, we met a resident who has lost her source of income.
It's hard to work right now when I clean houses and, you know, a lot of people don't need their houses cleaned right now. We're trying to get, like, the necessities that we need that I can't afford to buy right now. So that's our situation.
Parishioners say St. Andrew the Apostle Church will remain open as a distribution center for as long as possible to help their community get back on their feet.
We're not going anywhere. We're going to be with you here for the long term, as long as it takes, and make sure that as best as we can help you to rebuild and your community, the structures of your community.
With more than half of the 46 counties in the Diocese of Charlotte designated federal disaster areas, Bishop Michael Martin said the relief efforts kicked into gear almost immediately. 40 churches in the hard-hit areas became relief centers, while truckloads of supplies from Charlotte poured in. Now, more than a month since Hurricane Helene, the Diocese of Charlotte is shifting its focus on long-term recovery efforts. Bishop Michael Martin sends a message to all those affected.
God walks with you now as you mourn the loss of your loved one and as you try as best as you can to put one foot in front of the other to continue to rebuild your life and to live a life that can once again know happiness, can once and then again know blessing.
Russell Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
As relief services in the region shift towards long-term support, the Diocese of Charlotte says you can help. For information, go to its local Catholic Charities website. Volunteers are needed as well as donations to meet the needs of Hurricane Helene victims. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Outgoing President Joe Biden's attendance at a global summit tops the Week in Review. While in Peru for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC, a lame duck American president will meet with key world leaders like China's Xi Jinping. Biden touched down in Lima, Peru on Thursday, and Xi landed on Friday. The two will meet one-on-one on Saturday, the first time they've done so since last year's summit. The annual gathering brings together countries and members around the Pacific Rim that account for roughly two-thirds of global GDP and half the world's trade. With incoming President Trump's America First doctrine and tendency towards isolationism, China may soon play a stronger role in South America. During the visit, a new megaport will be inaugurated in Peru, which will cut shipping time between South America and China, as Chinese trade to South America is already booming. Earlier this week, President Biden met with the families of American hostages still held by Hamas. During the Wednesday meeting, Biden gave the families an update on the White House's efforts to bring their loved ones home from Gaza. In his last days in office, Biden is pushing for a breakthrough in stalled efforts for a ceasefire and hostage release. Jonathan Deckel-Henn, who provided an update on his son, Sagi, on our program last week, spoke to journalists after the meeting. He called on both the current and incoming administrations to work together now to rescue the hostages.
We have asked the president and his senior staff, as well as the incoming administration, to begin work immediately together, arm in arm, in order to not delay in any way, rather to multiply their forces in order to work immediately to pressure all sides, all parties in the hostage crisis to get them home.
There are 101 hostages remaining in Gaza, seven of whom are American. Four Americans are believed to be alive, unless at least three have died since October 7th of last year. And in Rome, Pope Francis met with former hostages held by Hamas and relatives of others still in captivity on Thursday. The survivors used the meeting to call for renewed efforts to free the remaining hostages, especially as another winter approaches. Many of the family members held photos of their missing loved ones. Pope Francis previously met with relatives of hostages last year. A major resignation on Tuesday in Great Britain as the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, stepped down for mishandling an abuse case involving what's believed to be the most prolific serial abuser associated with the Church of England. Welby has been one of the world's major faith leaders and has played a central role in British state occasions, including at the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II and the coronation of King Charles. But in resigning, the head of the Anglican Church admitted he had not done enough to lead a vigorous investigation into the abuses committed by lawyer and influential Christian John Smythe, who ran charity-organized summer camps for boys in Britain and also met boys through morality talks he gave at private schools. It is believed Smythe abused more than 100 boys and young men in Britain and later in South Africa and Zimbabwe over five decades, subjecting them to brutal physical beatings and sexual, psychological, and spiritual attacks. Welby learned of the claims in 2013 after he became archbishop, but did not report them to police. Smythe died in 2018 and was never criminally investigated. Welby is the most senior leader of a large historic church to ever resign in connection with sexual abuse scandals. To discuss the significance of this resignation, we are joined now by Edward Penton, senior correspondent for the National Catholic Register. He joins us from Canterbury, England. Edward, thank you for joining us. How significant and how surprising is this news of Welby's resignation following reports of his mishandling of this sexual abuse crisis?
Yes, well, it's very significant, Catherine, because this is the first time that an Archbishop of Canterbury, who's from the Anglican Church, of course, has resigned due to a scandal. This has never happened even before the Reformation. There were two resignations before the Reformation. They weren't because of scandal. And since 1928, Archbishops of Canterbury have stayed on until the age of 70, or at least they stayed on. They retired, rather. So this is very unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. And Edward, what's been the reaction by the faithful in Britain? How has this news been received?
Yes, well, I think most feel it was the right thing to do. The evidence was stacked against Archbishop of Canterbury. He admitted he hadn't done enough. And I think it was such a serious case that many people think it was right for him to go. Others have been quite sympathetic. They say that the safeguards that were there that weren't there at that time in 2013 when he found out about it, and they've been instituted since then. So they think, and also he'd only just become Archbishop at the time. But I think overall, most people think it was the right thing to have done. Mm.
And Edward, can you give us some more background as to how the Church of England's relationship is with the Catholic Church? Explain that dynamic for us.
Sure. Yes. I mean, it's not obviously part of the Catholic Church. It was split from Rome in the Reformation in the 16th century. So it's but there have been closer relations with the Anglican Church since the 1960s, at least on a sort of ecumenical basis. Pope Francis and Archbishop Welby had a good relationship, and I think I've heard that they're. They have almost identical views. So that's going to be a blow to Pope Francis.
Mm, absolutely. And Edward, can Welby's resignation, can it be compared to anything that we've seen in our Catholic Church in the wake of our own sexual abuse crisis?
Yes. I mean, we've seen Catholic bishops resign because of abuse scandals. We had Cardinal Bernard Law, of course, in Boston. We had Bishop of Bruges in Belgium in 2010. And just this year, we had two Polish bishops who resigned because of mishandling abuse cases. So this isn't unprecedented in the Catholic Church. And of course, Pope Francis has his own problems with mishandling abuse cases. We had the 2018 the problems with Chile, where he defended a bishop who later turned out to have been guilty. And then we, of course, have had the Father Rupnik case, the former Jesuit who's given preferential treatment despite having sexual and spiritual abuse, committing sexual and spiritual abuse against nuns in his mm-hmm. care. So we've had some serious problems of our own. But this is we haven't, of course, had a resignation like from the top, from like Archbishop of Canterbury, but we have had bishops resigning because of it.
Just a follow-up to that, Edward, do you think this resignation of Welby will influence any action the Catholic Church takes?
No, I don't necessarily think so. I think that both of them, both the Anglican Communion and the Catholic Church, have put in lots of safeguards over the past 10 years especially. It's something that Archbishop Welby and Pope Francis have been committed to. But as I say, there have been these problems with mishandling of cases. I think the hope is that going forward, these will be handled better. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I think there's been a sort of parallel development of safeguards within both mm-hmm. both the Anglican Communion and the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. You've reported on the Church of England for years, in addition to your work on the Catholic Church, of course. Edward, how will this impact the Church of England moving forward? I mean, you've written, again, about the Church being on the brink of schism before.
Yes, I mean, it is a schismatic church, the Anglican Church. It's already, we consider it to be that. And I think that whatever moral authority it's had over the past 500 years, it's been severely weakened, especially in the last 10 to 30 or even more years. And this I think, is just going to further weaken that moral authority. It's been a persistent criticism of the Anglican Communion, the Church of England, that it hasn't upheld the teachings of the Christian teachings, especially under Archbishop Welby's watch. It's been criticized as becoming a very leftist church, mm-hmm. a very communion, and adopting very much sort of woke culture. So I think it's going to just further undermine that moral authority that it used to once have up until fairly quite recently.
Mm. Edward Penton, we are grateful for your insight and your reporting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Catherine.
Now to an update to a story we first brought you back during the summer. A federal court in Louisiana has blocked a state law requiring schools to display the Ten Commandments in classrooms. In his ruling this week, the judge called the mandate coercive and unconstitutional. Republican Governor Jeff Landry signed the legislation earlier this year. The state's attorney general says Louisiana disagrees with the decision and will immediately appeal. We'll be right back.
So many doors closed in her face. They told her no, and she just kept going, and she fulfilled her mission.
Next, a sculptor shares the inspiration she got from the example of St. Francis Xavier Cabrini as a statue in the saint's honor is unveiled and blessed in Rome. This pilgrim of hope now stands ready for the 2025 Jubilee. That story when we return.
They wanted to bring her back here, and they wanted her here on today, her feast day, and also for the Jubilee in the coming year.
An image of a great saint comes home to her native Italy, just in time for a global celebration in the Catholic Church. This week, the church celebrated the feast day of St. Francis Xavier Cabrini, an Italian-born saint who ultimately became the first citizen of the United States to be canonized. She dedicated her life to serving Italian immigrants and orphans in America. In honor of her legacy, a new statue was unveiled in Rome. Cardinal James Harvey blessed the bronze statue of Cabrini in its new home, the garden of the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. The statue traveled all the way from Chicago, where Cabrini once lived, worked, and later died. 80 pilgrims from the Windy City accompanied the statue on its transatlantic voyage. Lucella, one of the artists behind the statue, hopes the image of Cabrini will be a symbol of hope for visitors.
She used St. Paul as an inspiration herself, and she overcame her fears and her challenges, personal challenges, to help others. And we'd like people to feel that when they see this.
The statue's arrival in Rome comes before the Jubilee year 2025, an event that will gather millions of pilgrims to the Eternal City. The Jubilee year will provide many opportunities for Catholics to get involved in the celebrations. And this week, the Vatican announced a special way for pilgrims all over the world to journey to St. Peter's Basilica from the comfort of their own home. Pope Francis received a sneak peek at a new 3D experience of St. Peter's Basilica, a special collaboration between the Vatican and the tech giant Microsoft. Microsoft created the digital twin of St. Peter's with the help of artificial intelligence and hundreds of thousands of high-resolution photos. It is one of the most technologically advanced and sophisticated projects of its kind, and even helps conservation efforts by revealing undetected cracks and missing tiles. EWTN News is gearing up to cover Jubilee 2025 all next year. This is just the beginning of many more stories to come. But that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.